Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to replay a few segments we previously broadcast prior to when the COVID-19 pandemic swept across Connecticut and the nation. The first of our encore segments features our January chat with the U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, along with another special guest and former smoker talking about the first new national report on smoking cessation since 1990 and providing information that can help support you kicking the habit today. Then we'll transition to the subject of hospice and a difficult conversation about hospice for children. As construction continues amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, we'll replay a January visit we had with the CEO of Regional Hospice and provide a reminder about the agency's mission to create the fifth inpatient children's hospice center in the entire nation, right here in Western Connecticut. And we'll close with a February segment highlighting a new partnership between Hazleton Betty Ford and Shatterproof and why this national partner has chosen to use a program that remains available to anyone who might need to use it today. Shatterproof's Just Five program for increasing awareness, reducing stigma, and sharing information about addiction prevention and treatment. We'll be back with these encore segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. The sculpture sensation that drew thousands of curious art lovers to Simsbury in 2018 is back. The Simsbury Chamber of Commerce Art Trail is once again delighting visitors with 37 lifelike bronze sculptures depicting people doing everyday activities placed outdoors throughout town. The works of internationally renowned sculptor and artist Seward Johnson will be on display through September 29th, and it's all outdoors in an ideal, safe destination for anyone looking for a distraction from the current virus situation. For more information and to make the best of your visit, just go to SimsburyArtTrail.com. Well, as you heard in our introduction, we're welcoming a very special and esteemed guest on the program this morning. We're calling down to Washington, D.C. to talk with the U.S. Surgeon General. Jerome M. Adams is on the line with us. Dr. Adams and Beatrice, a former smoker who was featured in the CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. We'll be talking to her shortly. What's most exciting is, as we're recording this on Thursday, January 23rd, literally just a couple of hours before we're taking this call, the Surgeon General released a report called Smoking Cessation, a report of the Surgeon General. And this is the first time, if I understand correctly, Dr. Adams, since 1990, that some sort of report on this issue was addressed. So welcome to the program and thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you having Beatrice on, too, because we love sharing those stories of people who have successfully quit using tobacco.
Great. Well, first of all, let's talk about the ramp up to this report. It certainly seems like there was plenty of time to put it together, but also a really long runway of data gathering, I imagine, since the last report came out.
Exactly. One of the things that I want folks to understand is that there is a distinction between initiation of tobacco product use and cessation. And this is the first report in 30 years detailing the science around what we know works to help people actually quit using tobacco. And that's critically important because 34 million Americans in this country still smoke, despite the fact that we know tobacco product use is the number one preventable cause of death and disease in this country. And unfortunately, one of the things that's highlighted in the report is that there are certain subgroups, like the LGBTQ community, American Indian and Alaskan Natives, and people with mental illness diagnoses who smoke at disproportionately high rates.
Is there any information in the report that speaks to why those populations might be so much more predisposed to using tobacco?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. We know that in many cases these groups were specifically marketed to, and that's one place where we're leaning into trying to help prevent, mitigate disparities. But in this report, one of the things we highlight is that the remedies we know work, things like FDA-approved medications, like behavioral counseling, like smoke-free environments, aren't able to be equally accessed by all different populations. For folks with mental illness, we know, unfortunately, there's this belief that, hey, we've got bigger fish to fry, and that we might actually hurt their progress if we talk about quitting smoking. But the fact is, and SAMHSA has shown this, that people are actually more successful in terms of dealing with their substance misuse and mental illness diagnoses if they are in a smoke-free environment and if they're given the tools, just like the rest of us out there, to live a smoke-free life.
Well, certainly a lot of other things have happened in the world of smoking since 1990. There's been a massive amount of legal action against the tobacco industry that has yielded millions, perhaps billions, in money coming back to states for smoking awareness and education, cessation programs. How has the data gathering that has contributed to the report you released earlier today, how has the that big bubble of information and activity around the lawsuits against the tobacco industry impacted both the ability to have good or better data and the sheer volume of that data that might have been available to you to update the report?
Well, John, you bring up a great and important point. The first Surgeon General's report on smoking came out in 1964. The only other report on cessation was in 1990. And the landscape has changed dramatically from a legal, a regulatory, and a product availability point of view over that time. And we have greater transparency and a greater ability to say who's smoking, why they're smoking, what they're being marketed to. And one of the things I want to highlight is that in this report, we talk about the different interventions that have evolved over the last 30 years, three decades, to help people quit. And I think of them in three buckets. I think of individual-level interventions, like the seven FDA-approved quit medications and behavioral counseling, that unfortunately only a third of people who make a quit attempt actually utilize. I think of healthcare systems, and unfortunately about 40% of smokers who see a healthcare provider are not advised to quit. So there's things we can do there to better enable and empower and incentivize healthcare providers to have a conversation with smokers about quitting. But then, as you allude to, there are population level interventions, things like smoke-free environments, things like CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign, which Beatrice is featured in. Things like raising the price of tobacco that we all know over 30 years of evidence shows that these are effective in helping people quit. And you hit on one of the keys, and I feel passionate about this as a former head of a state health department, that we need to more fully fund state tobacco control programs, because we know when they're fully funded, less people smoke, more people quit, and we save money, $300 billion in smoking-related expenses across this country, which comes out to about $1,000 for every man, woman, and child that it's costing our country, because we haven't done enough to help people quit smoking.
We're in a very riveting conversation with U.S. Surgeon General Jerome M. Adams. Dr. Adams is joined by Beatrice, a former smoker, as he said, who was featured in the CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. So Dr. Adams, certainly one of the stumbling blocks that smokers have could be one or a litany of attempts to quit in the past, and they had been
absolutely,
and they had been unsuccessful, and it just gets to the point where, whether it's one time or 20 times, the feeling of beating your head against the stone wall is just not doing anything for that wall. So let's take a few moments to actually tap into Beatrice's experience and talk to her a little bit about the fight to succeed in smoking cessation. Beatrice.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're going to love her story, John. You're going to love her story, because she hits on all the points that you just laid out, the difficulty that smokers have quitting, but the fact that with the right tools, they actually can be successful.
Right. So, Beatrice, you still have a few of those Band-Aids on your forehead, I guess, from when you were beating your head against the wall trying to quit smoking. Tell me a little bit. Tell me a little bit about that epiphany, that moment where you decided, no matter what happened in the past, how it didn't work, how horrible it made you feel when you weren't able to grab and light up a cigarette or whatever it was that you were consuming from a tobacco product standpoint. Tell us a little bit about that moment where you just put a stake in the ground and said, I'm going to change my life.
That moment came for me, actually, when my son wrote me a letter, and he was 11 years old. Before that, I wanted to quit, and I tried quitting several times, and I tried cold turkey, and I just was never successful. But then when I got this letter from my son, I saw that it wasn't just affecting me, it was affecting my family, and that cemented, I had to quit. It just made it really real for me, and I saw how it was affecting my family. And so that really was instrumental in helping me quit.
So how did you make it happen?
I decided this is it. I'm going to need help. I can't do it alone. So I tried doing it alone. It didn't work out. So I went to see my doctor, and she prescribed medicine for me. And also I got nicotine patches. And so with the combination of the nicotine patch and the medication that my doctor put me on, it was easier to quit.
So people who may have been lifelong smokers who never tried to quit may have heard from others that, it's a nightmare. It's not worth it. Certainly you're living proof that it's worth it. But what were some of the fallback moments? Did you relapse? Did from day one you were smoke free? Tell us a little bit about the challenging moments and the way that not smoking made you feel for a while before everything started being a little bit more okay.
Sure. Well, the first few times I would quit for maybe a week, and I would say to myself, oh, I could have a cigarette. I can control this. And so I would start off smoking one cigarette, and then that would be the relapse. It didn't stop at one. I would continue. So I'm sorry. Can you just repeat the question?
Oh, sure,
again?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. What were you feeling when you were not, when you were resisting that temptation to grab the cigarette? Because certainly I've heard from a lot of people that you get these almost withdrawal feelings.
Yeah, it's difficult. It definitely is. The first 3 months, I tell anyone who's trying to quit that the first 3 months are really difficult, and you have to keep yourself out of certain situations. Like if you like to go out for drinks, maybe you shouldn't do that the first 3 months or maybe first 6 months. If you were used to having a cigarette after dinner, you should probably skip that cigarette. Try not thinking about it. But having the letter that my son wrote to me was helpful, so that every time I felt like I needed a cigarette, I would just pull out the letter, read it, and see how it was affecting him. And that was, like, really motivating for me.
And John, yes. Beatrice hit on a few key points here. She hit on the fact that an individual can't do it alone, that they need a supportive environment. And so we know that smoke-free environments in restaurants, in workplaces, in buildings actually help people quit smoking, because then those social cues aren't there to trigger them or to make them at higher risk for relapsing. I think that's critically important for more people to understand.
Yes, Dr. Adams, I'm also hearing from Beatrice that what a lot of people may not understand is that they can experience multiple types of cessation tools. They can utilize multiple cessation tools at the same time.
And that's a key from our report, too, that combining FDA-approved quit medications and talking to your health provider, because one of the findings from the report is that you can actually utilize different medications in concert along with behavioral therapy to help. Make no mistake about it, John, nicotine is highly, highly addictive, and we need to give people the tools that we know work to help them become successful. Some stats that are in the report, 70% of current smokers want to quit. About half make a quit attempt every year, but only about a third of those who make a quit attempt actually have utilized FDA-approved medication. So we need to get more of the tools that we know work in the hands of the people who want to quit. And if we do that, we're going to save lives and we're going to save money.
So what are, in the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Surgeon General Adams, what are a few of the important resources people can go to and rely on to actually get the job of quitting smoking done?
A great question, and I want all your listeners to know that every state has a quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. You can call in right now and talk to someone about the tools that are available in your state to help you quit. There's counseling. Most of those quit lines also have access in some way, shape, or form to FDA-approved medications and adjuncts, which will help people quit. I also encourage people to go to smokefree.gov if you're on your smartphone or on the Internet. And there are great resources there to help you develop a quit plan, to help you know the array of options that are available to help you quit and to help you be successful in this journey. And then I would encourage people to, if you have access to the Internet, go to CDC's website and look at their tips from former smokers, because I'm just a Surgeon General, John, but it's people like Beatrice out there who've been through this, who really, as peers, can speak to those cravings, can speak to those social cues, but can also speak to the evidence-based tools that they utilize to help them overcome the challenges that are in front of them if they try to quit smoking.
Well, anybody who's listening has to know that they're not alone. They've got people like Beatrice. They've got people like you, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams. And they've got all of us here at Connoisseur Media Radio standing behind them, knowing that they can do it thanks to the tools that you're helping us become more aware of today. We want to thank U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams and Beatrice, a former smoker featured in CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. Smokefree.gov is a website where you can get started to make 2020 and January of 2020 the last month that you light up a cigarette or consume tobacco products for your life. So thank you, Dr. Adams and Beatrice, for being on the program this morning, and best of luck as you are celebrating the release of Smoking Cessation, a report of the Surgeon General that was dropped today as we record this on January 23rd, the first renewed report on smoking cessation since 1990. Thank you so much for being part of the show. It's been way too long since we were able to have a great conversation with Cynthia Roy. She's president and CEO of Regional Hospice. And on Wednesday, December 4th, Regional Hospice in Danbury revealed its North Star Pavilion, the first children's hospice in the Northeast and the fifth in the nation. This 18,000 square foot expansion was designed by the award-winning architectural firm Roger Ferris and Partners. And we're going to talk all about it today with Cynthia Roy, who's on the line with me. Cynthia, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Hope you had a great holiday, and looking forward to another year of incredible work at Regional Hospice. Man, this is going to be your fifth year anniversary in the what we're still calling the new building, right?
Yeah. Thank you, John, for having me. Yeah, it will be the fifth anniversary. It's hard to believe it's been 5 years already since we've been open.
So let's talk about Regional Hospice as an entity, because even long before this gorgeous new and quite unique hospice center was opened in Danbury, Regional Hospice was working really, really hard to support the hospice movement and all of the people who came to Regional Hospice for support for many years, right?
Yeah, I mean, the organization itself was started in 1983, so it was a really strong and vital organization long before I came along to build the building. But one of the things that I've been in hospice for 23 years, and one of the things that I knew when I came to build the building in 2007 was that we needed to have something like this in this part of the state, that there was really nothing else like it. And so we sought after the process of building it and changing the regulations in the state to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's ratchet things out really broad in terms of helping to once again articulate to people who have not experienced it, those families who have not been touched by it, and particularly the people out there who not only may be skeptical about hospice, but who actually may have heard misinformation that makes them think badly or lose trust in what hospice is all about.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good question. So hospice itself is a service that's provided both under private insurance and under Medicare and Medicaid that allows patients who have a 6-month of prognosis to get treatment and services in their home or in the setting that they choose to live in. And often, exactly what you said, John, is correct. People are very scared of the H word. They think that hospice means that you're dying, you have hours and days to live. But often, patients are referred to us long before that point. They are referred to us within 6 to 9 months of their passing, and really find that they wish that they had been, you know, referred to hospice earlier often in their disease trajectory because they need the support in the home or, you know, in their, you know, their emotional life to get through whatever diagnosis they're dealing with. But people are scared of the H word, right? It's a scary thing to think about death and dying, and we all are going to face it. So it's a tough thing for people to address. But certainly when they're willing to address the onset of an illness, it's very serious. And then the subsequent news, usually that people are hearing that treatment isn't working. Hospice is usually a godsend for them. It's an opportunity to get support services that they weren't even aware were available. So when people usually embrace the concept and they allow us into their homes and we have the privilege of caring for them, they find that it makes a huge difference in terms of the support that they need and the family needs primarily as well.
Mm. Do you think that people generally may not promote hospice, those who have used it, those who have been part of it, those whose lives have been enriched along with that of their late loved ones? Do you think that that they don't talk about hospice because once that person has passed, you suddenly kind of switch gears into that new chapter of mourning and all of the activities and business around the death of a loved one. And at that point, they just mainly want to kind of turn their attention in a different direction. So they're not out there really doing a lot of promotion or sharing about the great experiences that they've had.
Yeah, no, I've actually found the opposite. We do a patient satisfaction survey for caregivers when the patient has passed, and 95% of family members say that they would refer, you know, regional hospice to their friends and family after the service they've been, you know, they've gone through. People actually, I get hundreds of letters from families who are extremely appreciative of the service that they received. And what I always hear, the theme is that people had no idea what hospice could provide and are surprised and amazed at the support that they got through this illness because they didn't know what to expect. If you haven't been through a loss before and you haven't cared for someone close to you who's critically ill, you don't even know the beginning of what to do in the everyday life in terms of just bathing, dressing, and feeding, let alone medication administration, which can be extremely scary for a lot of family members. You know, how do you draw up a syringe out of a bottle? That's really frightening to somebody who's by themselves at home, you know, with no one else to call, and to have a support service available to you 24/7, I think has been invaluable. And I think when families have used the service, they rave about it and they continue to tell friends and family about it long after their loved one has passed. Certainly one of the things that we work on is we support families for well over a year after the loved one has passed through the bereavement support. So often people might say, oh, I don't need that service right away. I have lots of friends in the area who are here to support me. But they might find a holiday becomes really difficult, or friends and family leave, for, you know, when they move on to other things. And the focus of their loved one's illness is not forefront for them. And to be able to have somebody else to be able to support them through, you know, this grieving process is really pretty pivotal. Mm-hmm. So my experience has been that people, once they've used hospice services, they really are open to it. Sometimes getting there, though, John, is the hard part. People struggle with the word because I think historically people have thought of hospice, as I said, days and weeks before death or sometimes hours. And I think also people are really scared of the medication morphine, and they think automatically that hospice staff are going to come and administer morphine to their loved ones and somehow, speed up the process of their passing, when in fact it's actually the opposite. Morphine is the gold standard in pain management, and actually it's used even when women have babies, we use morphine, but we just don't call it that. It's a different medication. Mm-hmm. So people are very afraid of those words, and I think that we really try hard to educate and demystify those words so people understand they're not as scary as one might believe. Mm.
Do you think people generally think a hospice is for the last few hours or days?
Oh, yeah. We've done studies on this, and we have found that most families believe that and are kind of surprised. I had a lady who was in my center who was 46 years old, and when her family let their friends know that she was in the center and she was on hospice, they said, oh, is she awake? Can she even talk to us? Can she communicate? And can we sit down with her? Well, this lady was, cruising around our building, eating wonderful food and having friends at her bedside and really enjoying those moments with her loved ones. And wasn't, in her last hours and days, and in fact lived with us for 4 months in our center beautifully, when had sleepovers with her family and really had such an amazing end to her life. And it was really a celebration of her life. And that's what we really try to focus on, both within the center, but also for patients who are at home who wish to remain at home until the end. We are really about living fully until you die. It's not about dying. It's about living. And I think that's the misnomer people have about hospice sometimes, is that, oh gosh, you're imminently dying. And that's not necessarily the case. Yeah. If it is the case, our goal is to make somebody as comfortable as possible and provide the support to their family through that process.
Mm. I don't have a large circle of acquaintances who are involved in hospice, especially to the extent you are, Cynthia Roy, but I think it was you that told me back when we met, 7, 8, 9 years ago, that occasionally someone who goes into hospice actually becomes well and leaves hospice to go on and live a very productive and fulfilling rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. That is actually true. It's a very small percent, but we do have a number of people that we call them our graduates, mm-hmm. that haven't had a lot of attention, and maybe they're elderly and they're not getting a lot of visitors, and all of a sudden our hospice team is coming in regularly and they're getting tons and tons of visitors, and they perk up and they do really well and they graduate. I had a 110-year-old lady graduate from hospice. Mm. Took a break for a year, traveled to Florida, did very well, and then came back on our hospice program when her disease progressed. Mm. She was very lucky. She found herself in a situation where she had a remission. But that doesn't always happen. But when it does, those are great experiences. And, being on hospice is very different than regular home health. Regular home health care, you can't travel, you can't go on vacation, you can't do any of that. On hospice, you're allowed to travel, and we encourage that. So we have lots of people that go to Disney with their grandkids. And we call ahead and make arrangements with a team in Florida and make sure that they're being followed by, a hospice team in Florida. And you can do all of that on hospice, which people don't realize that with regular home health, you're very limited in home health care in terms of having to be homebound and having to not leave the home. And that's not the case for hospice at all. And that's one of the wonderful things about the Medicare hospice benefit.
We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk more with Cynthia Roy, President and CEO of Regional Hospice. Stay with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting an awareness or fundraising activity, or you'd like to find one that's supporting a nonprofit in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find out how to promote it, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Boquette, your public affairs director. We'll be back to today's encore episode of the award-winning For the People right after this news. As we all deal with the challenging demands of the coronavirus, the start of hurricane season is snuck up on us, and it's important to get prepared. Because of COVID-19, getting prepared is going to look a little different than in other years. And with that thinking in mind, the American Red Cross here in Connecticut has tips to help you with virtual preparedness workshops. Be Red Cross Ready is their free virtual virtual presentation to help you and your loved ones prepare for emergencies, specifically home fires and hurricanes. And it's offered each remaining Thursday during the month of June at 2 p.m. If you'd like more information on Be Red Cross Ready or to join a session, just go to redcross.org/CT. Thanks for sticking with us. We're back with Cynthia Roy, President and CEO of Regional Hospice. Well, I know you mentioned the morphine stigma, but are there any other misconceptions that you find people have about hospice that really keep you up at night because you know that those misconceptions may be preventing them from either supporting or referring a loved one to hospice care?
Yeah, I think there's a couple. I think people are very private, and I think sometimes they struggle with having what they would term as, you know, strangers in their home. I think that's sometimes a very scary thing for people. But I think once they realize, you know, a nurse can come in and, you know, rearrange the medications and change the protocol with a physician and get the medications into a better organized schedule that a person actually feels better and that their loved one actually wants to get up and get out of bed, they're surprised by that outcome. So I think that once people can get over that initial, like, oh, I don't know if I want people in my home feeling, which is tough, it really, they find that it's a much bigger benefit than the drawback part. And that's also one of the reasons why I built the center, so that if people don't want people coming in and out of their home and they aren't sure about their loved one being in their home, they have this center as an option for them if they choose to place them with us in the center. And the other kind of surprise about the center is that patients don't always die in our center. Patients come into our center for respite. They come in for symptom management. If they have a particular symptom that's been difficult, we don't send patients to the hospital. We bring them into our center for symptom management. And then we bring them home when they feel more comfortable. And that's really pretty common. And that's been a huge relief to a lot of our families where they don't want to go 911 to the ER again. And they want their loved one comfortable, but they're concerned because their symptoms are such that maybe they're difficult to manage at home. Mm-hmm. So that's been a big surprise, I think, in terms of having that as an option. And I think the other piece, too, is just, you know, being open to having, you know, different people in your, you know, your medical care. It's such a difficult system now to navigate healthcare. And the nice thing about hospice is that we navigate it for families. So we can, you know, predict and say these are the things that are happening. And we try to really be proactive in preparing families for the what ifs, the things that are coming down the pike, so that people are aware and comfortable. And people have gotten so out of the habit of having healthcare providers give them those options and, you know, prepare that landscape for them, that they are kind of surprised and very relieved that they have a support team available.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really nice is at 2 o'clock in the morning, if someone is really, you know, nervous and they're not sure about how to care for their loved one, they can get a hospice nurse 24/7. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, a hospice nurse can come out to their house and get them comfortable. And having that 24/7 availability is really invaluable.
Well, certainly one of the what ifs that no one is ever prepared to deal with is the what if when they find out that a child or a young person is diagnosed with some sort of a critical or fatal illness or condition. Mm-hmm. And that's where North Star Pavilion comes in. This is just, you know, it's incredible to think that there's only 5 centers like this in the entire country, and you're sitting in one right now here in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. This was a long time coming, but is quite a necessary service, and really I have to imagine makes all the difference in the world when parents and loved ones are facing that most horrible diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the worst words a parent can ever hear, is that there's nothing more they can do for their child or that the treatment isn't working. Connecticut is an unusual and thankfully a good state in that we allow in the state of Connecticut children to be on treatment for their illness simultaneously as they can be on a hospice program. And that's a pretty amazing service, because what that does is it allows families to get to know our service providers early on in the, you know, critical illness of their child. So a child may be diagnosed with a, you know, a life-limiting illness that could, you know, they could live with for a year to a year and a half, and they're getting treatment perhaps to prolong their life, but they can be on hospice simultaneously. So we will provide support in the home as well as the support they're getting from their medical provider. And we work in tandem with them to do that. Regional has had a pediatric program for many years. In fact, we were one of the only ones that did early on, probably 12 or 15 years ago, we started a perinatal hospice program. And that's very unique. And that is for mothers who know that their baby is going to be born with a life-limiting illness. They choose to carry the baby to term and then the subsequent death or illness of the child when the baby's born. Believe it or not, many, many of those babies that we've walked hand in hand with families in that delivery process actually end up living much longer than ever anticipated and usually live, you know, 3 to 6 to 9 months after the baby's born and get really pretty amazing and precious time with that baby. And it actually makes the grief process entirely different because they get to know their baby. And while it's extremely brave and difficult for people to make those decisions, they do. And to have a support system in place that allows them to do that, I think, is a gift. And so we're very proud of that program. But we also take care of, unfortunately, a number of children who are born or who or find out that they have a life-limiting illness and they're, you know, in 3, 4, 5 years old, up to 18. And every day we have a fair amount of kids on our program at home who are getting pediatric hospice support. And we have a unique and amazing pediatric team that manages those kids. But when I built the building 5 years ago, I had always intended to have children in the center, and we've had a number of them. But we found that really kids need their own space. And even though our building is incredibly child-friendly and it has a playground and it has things that nobody else in the country has, to have its own unique patient care unit is something pretty special. And we're modeling our program very similarly after a program in Phoenix called Ryan's House. And that program has been around for 18 years, and it was started by a family whose child was born with a life-limiting illness and, in fact, just passed away last year at the age of 18, Ryan. And their goal was to provide a place for terminally ill children to go both for respite but also for symptom management. So the goal of the North Star Pavilion is to provide respite to terminally ill children as well. So if mom or dad need to get away and haven't had a break in a really long time, the North Star will allow them to come and stay there for 2 or 3 days, you know, up to 5 days, at no cost to their family members, and the family can get a break. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because in Connecticut, and in fact the whole Northeast, there's nothing like this, which is kind of shocking in this day and age. And we have lots of families currently who would love to take part in this service because, you know, their child is critically ill. They don't feel comfortable leaving their child with a babysitter or someone who's not medically trained, and this allows them the opportunity to do that. The unit also will serve as a place for children to pass in as well. And one of the things over the years I've heard over and over again from family members who have had children who've died on our service is that they thought they wanted their child to die at home. That was very important to them. And in fact, after the passing of their child, they'll often say to me, "I wish she didn't die at home, because I want to remember her living in our home and not dying in our home." Mm-hmm. And often that's the case for siblings too, where you've got other little kids in the house, and they'll always remember their sibling dying at home. And the nice thing about the North Shore Pavilion is they can leave the death behind someplace else, and they can always remember their child living in that house. Yeah. And I think that families, if you've never been through this before, families don't know what to anticipate, and this is something we've seen as a common issue.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Cynthia, because the cliched image that we see so often in TV shows and motion pictures and theater is the child has passed, and then for months or even years, the room is left untouched, or they can't stand to go into the room, or they never really use the room again. And it does serve as that kind of reminder within the household. So I'm glad you brought that perspective up about the child passing in the hospice environment, particularly in such a unique environment as the North Star Pavilion, which you just opened in December, earlier this month. So before we let you go, the last thing we want to leave people with is a kind of a user-friendly way or an easy way for them to learn more about hospice. And you've developed this wonderful video series that launched about a year and a half ago, maybe almost 2 years ago, I guess, including this latest one, Emily's Last Wish. Let folks know about your video series, and then we'll say farewell for now.
Emily's Last Wish is a story of a young girl. Her name was Corinne, but we call her Emily. And the purpose of this piece is to talk about her last wish being that we build a unit specifically for kids like her. So we've done an award-winning commercial campaign. It's an animated campaign, and we actually have our fourth commercial coming out in January. We work with a well-known artist, J.J. Settlemyer, who did Beavis and Butthead and another really interesting character. He's been on SNL, as well as John Calhoun, and they're the animators who've done these pieces. So Emily's Last Wish is a rendition on one of our commercials that's on our website. You can either go to emilyswish.org or regionalhospicect.org to see it. But it really tells the story of Corinne and the things that she wanted to do in her last days with us in the center. She passed in the center. And why it's so important to have the North Star Pavilion built in Connecticut, to be one of only five in the country and really the only one in the entire Northeast, which I think is an incredible thing to have for our community and the surrounding states around us. But I wish the people would go on and see the animation, and please share it, because I think you rarely see animation around these topics. And I think it really takes very heavy topics that we all are going to deal with day in and day out. It's all different stories. It's a spouse story that's coming out in January. It's a children's story. Children who are caring for an elderly dad, and tell sort of the funny tales around what it's like to care for an aging parent and make light of it in a really, I think, meaningful but also powerful way.
Excellent.
So I encourage people to take a look at it and share it, because really we all kind of relate to these issues on a variety of different levels.
RegionalHospiceCT.org is the website to go. Our guest this morning, Cynthia Roy, President and CEO of Regional Hospice. As we heard earlier this month, they unveiled plans for the North Star Pavilion, the first children's hospice in the Northeast and only the fifth in the nation, as we heard from Cynthia, with plans to open in what you said, early 2021, Cynthia?
2021, yes, that's our goal.
Excellent. Well, we thank you for all the work that you and your staff and all your incredible volunteers and supporters do at Regional Hospice, and wish you luck with this. I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. RegionalHospiceCT.org is where you need to go for all the information. And Happy New Year, Cynthia, and we'll talk to you again soon. Well, we have been very pleased to be able to work with an organization here in Connecticut called Shatterproof, which is actually a national nonprofit dedicated to reversing the addiction crisis in the United States by transforming addiction treatment, shattering addiction stigma, most importantly, and advocating for federal and state policy change and payer reform, also supporting and educating the community. And we were so pleased just a short time ago to receive notice that Shatterproof is now going to be partnering with the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation, utilizing a resource for families that has been successfully implemented by Shatterproof. We have their Executive Vice President, Stephen D'Antonio, on the phone with us this morning to talk about it. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, John, and thank you for the kind introduction.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your role at Shatterproof.
Sure. So I did not start in the addiction space. I had a 30-year business career at Morgan Stanley, where I ran global trading businesses. I was also a member of their 40-person management committee. And then along the way, one of my five children ended up having a problem with substances, a very serious addiction problem. And as many people know, with this problem, your head's spinning as a parent. There's so much fear and so many things going on. And I decided to retire and really get into the addiction space and learn as much as I could learn as much as I could about the disease, and then try and help as many people as possible. And I've done that over the last few years, becoming a parent peer volunteer or creating a position at Northwell Health outpatient clinic in Long Island, I created a podcast series with a top treatment center called Karen Treatment Center. I co-created it with two other friends. I also spent a year at Harvard University doing a fellowship to learn how to create scalable social change and to take grad level courses in addiction. And then I found my way to Shadowproof. I met Gary Mendel, and that was another life changer.
Great. Well, we've described what Shatterproof has been doing. So tell me a little bit about how the connection between Shatterproof and Hazelden Betty Ford happened.
Sure. So as you probably know in talking to Gary, Shatterproof has deep connections with a lot of business organizations, one of which is Optum, Optum Behavioral Health, which is part of the United Healthcare system. And there's an amazing person there named Deborah Nussbaum, who has big responsibilities in trying to help reverse the opioid epidemic as well. And I had a relationship with her prior to Shatterproof. She has deep relationships with treatment centers. And she basically put Hazelden Betty Ford and Shatterproof together because she thought there would be a good partnership. And the partnership is really all about the fact that Hazelden has great services and things that they can provide for people who are ready for treatment, but they don't have anything really for families that are just getting started. And so our training is all about people who are in those very, very early stages that maybe aren't sure there's a problem or they just don't know where to begin. Hazel gets tens of thousands of calls per year, and a good portion of them are not ready for any kind of services. And so what Hazelden is going to do is take this training and deliver it to those callers who could benefit from an educational experience.
So this is part of the reason why that collaboration idea made so much sense from Shatterproof's perspective?
Yeah. So we are going to collaborate with them on other things. It's obviously a big name in the business, huge brand. But this was, you know, a very direct, important business idea and relationship. And so we literally signed a deal. I got the legal agreement from Hazelden on Thanksgiving Day. We signed the deal then, and we've been working on implementing it up until the recent press release.
Very good. So then I guess the next important thing to talk about is Just Five. Give us an overview of that program and how successful it's been for Shatterproof's audience.
Sure. So I'm going to go high level. I started with this notion that people's heads are spinning, you know, when they first have an inkling that there might be a problem with addiction. And the problem with resources that are out there is that they're overwhelming. Even for me, after spending a year studying it, I would go onto websites and it was just too much stuff. And so when I showed up at Shatterproof and collaborated with their incredible team, the idea was, let's create something that is highly curated and is only the best, most important stuff that people should know that they don't know. And so we ended up creating six lessons. That's it. 5 minutes a piece. That's why it's called Just Five. And, you know, it's meant for the world that we live in today where people don't have any time. They have very short attention spans. So each lesson just takes 5 minutes. I could go through the quickly, spend a minute.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure,
are.
Sure.
Well,
they can do this online, on their phones, on their tablets, wherever they 100%. Are. I mean, for the amount of time it takes to go out and maybe, you know, have a smoke or take a break in a quiet place for a cup of coffee, they can benefit from one of the segments of this program.
John, that's exactly right. We designed it so that it looks very good on a computer, but we really designed it for a phone. Because this is it's such a stigmatized thing that people really want to access information in the most private way possible. And so, yeah, on their commute home, on their phone, you know, it's designed in that way. You could do any one of the six lessons, you know, in 5 minutes. So the six topics are the first one, is the science of addiction. Half the country thinks that addiction is a personal failing. It turns out that there's neuroscience behind it that shows the brains are actually restructured. And so we deliver that message in an animation, and then we have expert testimony talking about it. The second topic is, who's at risk? Who's vulnerable? And it turns out the most vulnerable population are people that have other mental illnesses, and also the young, adolescents, because their brains are not fully formed. And so we go through all of that. Then we have a whole segment on opioids, because obviously with tens of thousands of people dying every year in this country with opioid overdoses, there's a lot to learn in that arena. Then probably the most valuable thing that we have is lesson four, where we introduce something that I had no idea about until it was mentioned in pretty much every class I took in the fellowship learning about addiction. And that is a diagnostic called DSM-5. That's the gold standard. It was created by the American Psychiatric Association. And it's 11 yes or no questions that basically tell people whether or not they have no problem, a little problem, a medium problem, or full-blown addiction. And it's simple language. We introduce it, and I wish everybody in America could become familiar with those 11 questions. Because the biggest reason why people don't seek help is they don't think they have a problem. If you read those 11 questions and answer them honestly, you'll know. And then the last two lessons are how to help somebody who has a problem. And the final lesson is recovery, because there are so many dark and negative stories about addiction, but there are millions of people in this country that have beautiful, uplifting stories about recovery. And so we wanted to make sure that we introduced that topic with three very relatable, uplifting stories of darkness and then recovery and just unbelievable lives that people are living.
Wonderful. And the other exciting thing that we can hit in the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Stephen, is how Shatterproof can and is working with employers, not sure. just here in Connecticut, but anywhere within the sounds of our voice, to integrate and make this program kind of subtly available to anyone in their workforce.
Sure. Well, I can just tell you the first company that rolled it out with us was in October. We finished the program. It was JP Morgan Chase. They rolled it out globally. Connecticut's own, the Hartford Insurance, is rolling it out in the next week. GE has rolled it out. Optum Behavioral Health has rolled it out. Highmark Health. So we have a local union in New York City, 16,000 members. We have a state, the state of North Dakota. And so I, frankly, have been shocked at how overwhelming the response has been. We have 15 companies and employers that have signed, another 50 in the queue. And it turns out it's really not any competition for a product that's really designed for organizations to roll it out to their individual constituencies. Each organization gets their own landing page and their own URL for the training, and so they can customize that for their population, which is a big deal. And then we provide other stuff. I mean, really, it's meant to be turnkey. Because having worked at Morgan Stanley for 30 years, I know people get interested in stuff, but they just don't have time. And so we've made it turnkey by creating all the marketing materials. Companies really have to do very little to get access to this training. It's anonymous. We just give them their own URL, and they roll it out to their employees.
Fantastic. Well, for folks joining us, we're talking with Stephen D'Antonio. He's Executive VP of Shatterproof, which is dedicated to reversing the addiction crisis in the United States. We're helping them with their rollout of their new Just Five online education program, which we're hearing is aimed at helping more people learn about the disease of addiction and, if possible, facilitating getting assistance for those folks. The other exciting piece of news, as the nation's largest nonprofit treatment provider, Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation is going to use Shatterproof's Just Five as a resource for families who call its helpline and could benefit from an initial education on addiction. Your company and your employee workforce can also benefit from it, as we heard from Stephen, so many are. If you'd like more information about this or to learn all there is to know about this, this great organization, just go to shatterproof.org and we'll get you started. Thanks so much for chatting with us this morning, Stephen, and we look forward to following up with you at some point in the next few months and see how this rollout is really making a difference. So for now, we say farewell and thanks for being on the program, and we'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.